From 90.9 WBUR, I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston. On the show today, we'll have the latest on this weekend's fatal police shooting of a mentally ill Boston man and the persistent gap in services for people suffering acute mental distress.
Individuals who suffer from paranoia, schizophrenia, you don't know what they're up, but you know what they're up to. And so, they can suddenly act out, and it's unfortunate.
Plus, do Boston Uber drivers discriminate against African-American riders?
Although we've made great strides over the last few decades, discrimination is still here, and we as a society can do better, and hopefully we will do better.
Also, a new kind of preservation movement seeks to save America's social justice history.
Slavery, segregation, oppression of immigrants, we have to confront those parts of our past, and we are starting to. And that's the most exciting part of preservation.
It's Radio Boston, first the news.
Thanks for listening to the Radio Boston podcast. If you'd like to support WBUR, go to radioboston.org and click the pledge button in the upper right-hand corner. Okay, back to the show.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and we'll start today with more on Sunday's fatal police shooting of 31-year-old Terrence Coleman in Boston's South End. Coleman's mother says she called 911 early Sunday morning after her son had been sitting on their Shawmut Avenue stoop for nearly 2 days. The Boston Globe reports that Coleman had been diagnosed with paranoia and schizophrenia some 15 years ago, and that police had been called to Coleman's home a dozen times in the past decade. On Sunday morning, officers arrived with EMTs. What happened next is under investigation. The Boston Police Department says Coleman attacked the EMTs with a knife, causing officers to respond with deadly force. His family says he was not armed. Terrence Coleman's death is once again raising questions about the degree of crisis training police officers receive and about the gap in services for people in acute mental distress. We're going to take a look at both of those issues right now. Joining us first from Washington is Chuck Wexler, Executive Director of the Police Executive Research Forum, a law enforcement policy and research organization. He's a Boston native who formerly held a number of key civilian positions in the Boston Police Department, including operations assistant to the police commissioner. Chuck Wexler, welcome to Radio Boston.
Nice to be with you.
So I understand, first of all, that just a little bit earlier today, you actually spoke to or were briefed by Boston Police Commissioner Bill Evans about what happened on Sunday. What did he tell you?
Well, I actually called him in anticipation of being on this program. I really wanted his insights. I've known Commissioner Evans for probably 20, 25 years, and I know how committed he is to this whole subject. As a matter of fact, he was one of 25 police officials that went with us to Scotland this year to learn about de-escalation techniques. You know, they don't have guns there for the working police officers. So Bill Evans was one of those individuals, so I know him well, mm-hmm. and I really wanted to get his insight on this incident.
And what did he tell you?
Well, it's a tragedy, it's always sad when a parent loses their child like this, and he certainly feels that. But it's one of those situations where police nationally are increasingly called to these kind of situations, and the Washington Post has tracked use of force cases, and about 25% of them involve people who are mentally ill. In this situation, you had this individual who, as you described, has suffering from schizophrenia, paranoid schizophrenia. The police had been there 12 times. The officers who responded had already been trained in crisis intervention teamwork, CIT. They had gotten 12 hours training. They'd been, on the job for 2 years. And they got there and they called EMT, the emergency ambulance people, who responded. And, they really, they did everything right in terms of slowing it down, getting assistance, not rushing in, all of that. And then the EMT people apparently went in to try to talk to this individual. And that's when things really escalated in some ways.
So, Mr. Weichel, let me just jump in here because I want to be sure that I understand what you're saying correctly. So you're saying that Commissioner Evans told you that the two officers involved in Sunday's shooting, they'd been on the force for 2 years, so they were 2 years out of their police academy training?
Correct.
And did they receive this crisis intervention training as part of their academy education or after they graduated from police academy?
Well, I believe as part of it, actually in Massachusetts, everybody is mandated to get 12 hours training. So I would assume this was part of their academy training. In addition, they get in-service training during the year. So that they were reflective of a lot of departments. But I know Boston has made a special effort to really look at these kind of situations and how do you go upstream, if you will. How do you figure out how to slow it down, use time and distance, and really communication skills? I think the presence of the EMTs was important, but there was a sense that having them talk to this individual rather than police officers might help to diffuse it. You know, an officer in a uniform with a gun and everything can sometimes raise anxiety levels. So these cops stood back, let the EMTs go in, and that's when things
I mean, in fact, what we're seeing reported by the Boston Globe today is that that it was Terrence Coleman's mother, Hope Coleman, who didn't want to let the officers in precisely because she feared that their presence might further agitate her son. So the EMTs went in first. And again, this is what the Boston Globe is reporting. And that then there soon thereafter, the officers may have heard one of the EMTs raise their voices, which is what then prompted the following, the action thereafter, which there's some dispute about whether there was or wasn't a knife being wielded by Mr. Coleman. I mean, when you say slow things down, what ideally, you know, should happen in those events where the officers couldn't perhaps not see exactly what was going on and they had to respond to raised voices?
Well, when we say slow things down, I mean, the tendency had been historically for police to go to these situations to barge right in and feel like the best thing was to resolve it quickly. What we've learned, especially in dealing with people who have mental health issues, is there's some kind of crisis that has precipitated this. And the best thing is communication and to talk to people. And when I say slow it down, simply to get other professionals to the scene. You know, in Boston, you have, you know, an area that's rich in many hospitals and mental health people. In fact, the Boston Police Department have arrangements with mental health professionals to ride with them at night. So in this situation, the best thing to do would be to get like EMTs and others there so that, you know, the police then sort of step back. In this situation, having the EMTs go in seemed to make sense. It looked like this individual needed to be transported to the hospital. He needed help. And look, the last thing anyone wants is to take a life in this situation. It's devastating. You can do everything right, and yet you have something like this that happens. And you know, time will tell as we sort it out and figure out what exactly happened. But you know, I feel for that family, but I also feel for those police officers in the sense that they will never be the same. They will be devastated by this. So it's a tragedy all around.
Mm. Did Commissioner Evans, was he able to tell you anything else about specifically what happened on Sunday?
No, simply that this is a tragedy, and he felt, you know, personally very bad. Yesterday he told me he met with a lot of community people and to talk through this and explain it to them and to really try to, you know, put it in perspective. Look, this is a nationwide problem. This kind of call where the police are called to a location, you know, a dozen times where you have this individual, you know, it's interesting because who does a parent call when their kid is in trouble? They call the police. And you hope that the police, you know, have the kind of training. We have just released training called ICAT, which involves integrating communications, assessment, and tactics. And that's what you had in this situation. You had a communications issue, and then you had tactics issues. And And I think this is with the number of these kind of calls escalating. And they're really, you know, they're really difficult calls. But we do know that, you know, there are better ways to do it. But Boston Police, you know, to their credit, really have been exploring how do they continue to improve. They have their... They have been involved with us in training.
Yeah. Mr. Wexler, I'm sorry to interrupt you because I didn't mean to cut you off there, but I do have one more question for you before we have to let you go here. I take your point that very frequently police officers are sort of the first responders in these cases, and that yes, there has been increased training in Massachusetts in recent years, but nevertheless, as everyone acknowledges, something didn't go right on Sunday.
Right.
A man is dead. I'm wondering what in addition could have been done. Should we be having mental health professionals? I don't even know if they're the resources for this, being part of these response teams when
yes.
the calls come in and we know that there's someone in acute mental distress. So it's not just police officers.
Well, I totally agree with you. And then the original CIT training came out of Memphis 20 years ago, and it was to have a partnership with health professionals. In this particular case, you did have EMT there. You did have professionals. Now, were they the best? No, probably, you know, they weren't necessarily trained in psychology, but they were EMTs, and so having EMTs go in seems to me to be, you know, a better solution than just having police go in. Look, I totally agree, as would Commissioner Evans. This is a tragedy. I feel for that parent. I mean, the last thing that police want to do in these kind of situations is take a life. I will tell you what Boston Police will do, to their credit, is they will go back, they will look at this, and they'll see what could we have done differently. You know, there was a time when people would say, we don't want a Monday morning quarterback. Today, we look at these incidents as unfortunate and difficult as they are and say, what could we do better?
Well, Chuck Wexler is Executive Director of the Police Executive Research Forum, a law enforcement policy and research organization based in Washington. He's a Boston native who has held key civilian positions in the Boston Police Department, including operations assistant to the police commissioner. Chuck Wexler, thank you so very much.
Thank you.
Well, let's turn now to June Binney. She's Director of Criminal Justice Diversion for the National Alliance on Mental Illness Massachusetts. She joins us on the line. June Binney, welcome to Radio Boston.
Thanks so much, Magda.
So respond to what you just heard Chuck Wexler tell us. I mean, he says that Commissioner Evans says that the two officers involved in Sunday morning's fatal shooting had been on the force for 2 years, and that they had received some 12 hours each of some form of crisis intervention training. NAMI has been, your organization has been involved with Massachusetts law enforcement across the state in terms of some of this training. What could those 12 hours of training have been?
Well, let me just back up by saying that, you know, our project at NAMI has been working for the last almost 5 years to support police departments to get training and technical assistance that they need to respond to people with mental illness and substance use disorders safely and humanely. And really what we're trying to do is promote a uniform statewide strategy in these programs. And, you know, I also want to just reiterate what Chuck said, which is obviously the death of Terrence Coleman is an unspeakable tragedy, and you know, my condolences to the family, and I too feel for the first responders who have to go into these very difficult situations.
Well, I think we're definitely all in agreement on that. Anytime a life is lost, it's a tragedy for everyone in the community. So that's why I'm even more eager to have your help in understanding what kind of training officers do receive. Because I'm looking back in 2013, the Massachusetts Municipal Police Training Committee, which was, you know, part of the Executive Office of Public Safety and Security, actually made an announcement, and NAMI was part of this announcement.
That officers
in Massachusetts police academies were going to receive 12 hours per officer of some kind of crisis intervention training. That was a 200% increase from the 4 hours they were receiving in the police academy before that. So what kind of training are police recruits receiving when it comes to this kind of interaction they may have?
So the training that we partnered with the State Department of Mental Health and all the police academies, the Municipal Police Training Committee, and developed this 12-hour program, which we're exceedingly proud of, and launched it in October of 2013. I would say more than an introduction to these issues, but less than the kind of training that we think needs to be ongoing as police are in the communities and on the job. So the training happens during the 800-hour curriculum that every new police recruit in Massachusetts goes through, and it's wonderful. I would actually say that Massachusetts went from worst to first in terms of training new police recruits, but it's only one piece of the puzzle.
What are the specific things that the training entails? I mean, is it role play? Is it these de-escalation tactics? I mean, because the range of mental distress that they might be encountering in people they're responding to has got to be quite broad.
So they learn a bit about the signs and symptoms of mental illness. They learn about veterans' issues. They learn about hoarding and other kinds of, the teenage brain, I mean, you know, sort of specialized populations. And they do some role playing and practical exercises. Again, it's like any other kind of learning and training. It needs to be reinforced and it needs to be built upon and it, needs to continue. So, but it's a great foundation. And again, we're really proud of it and proud of the partnership that we were able to put together as an advocacy organization with government, got all the support that we needed from the academies to roll this out. And we've probably trained something like 1700 or 1800 new officers since that rolled out. So it's wonderful. It's wonderful.
Earlier you said it's wonderful, but just to start, not fully adequate for the kind of training you'd like to see officers receive overall.
That's correct. So the next thing we did was, and we were at the academy's request, we boiled that 12-hour training to 3 hours. And in calendar year 2015, every one of the 18,000 municipal police officers in the state received that 3-hour block. So that, too, is something that we're incredibly proud of.
June Binney, let me just jump in here because I do, forgive me for interrupting you, but I do want to ask you something about this gap in services or our ability to respond to people who are in acute mental distress. Because I was seeing a quote here in the Boston Herald from Mayor Marty Walsh, and he was quoted in the paper saying that an officer is not a clinical social worker. They have training, but again, it's a situation that seems to have gone beyond that. And then he said, I think if Terrence Coleman's mother had a number to call where a professional could go and help, that would have been more appropriate for that to happen. But I'm also seeing that Hope Coleman, Terrence Coleman's mother, told the Boston Globe that she called originally the South End Community Health Center in preparation to bring her son to Tufts Medical Center around midnight before the Sunday shooting, police shooting. But she was advised to call for an ambulance. So do you see, like, is that not where where this very specific and worrisome gap exists, if people are being advised to actually call 911 first?
Yeah, again, without all the facts coming out, it's really, it's very difficult. And yes, there are all kinds of gaps in services for people experiencing mental health crisis. Massachusetts actually has a very rich system of something called emergency services programs. There's 21 of them around the state regionally. And they are available 24/7 for people to call. They tend to only respond to people who are on MassHealth as opposed to commercial insurance, but they will also respond mobily in certain instances. You know, the other program that Boston actually has, which lots of communities would long to have, is a member of that emergency services program, a clinician from the BEST team, the Boston Emergency Services team, actually does go out on patrol calls, on police calls, with the Boston Police in either two or three precincts in police.
Yeah.
That's called the co-response model.
Well, June, let me just ask you one last question. Before we're all flat out of time here, but I'm curious. I mean, for people listening who have loved ones that may end up in acute mental distress someday, maybe some of them are wondering, who should I call?
Right. So I think, again, I think, people should call their emergency services providers, but in an acute emergency, people need to rely on 911 because that's where you're going to get the immediate response. And that's why we are all invested in having well-trained, well-supported police officers so that they have every tool in their tool belt when they come into these incredibly complex situations where they were not, this was not a traditional part of policing to respond to someone in an acute mental health crisis. And, you know, we need to give our police the support so that they can respond in a way that keeps all of our communities healthy and safe.
Yeah, and for a whole variety of reasons, it's becoming a larger part of policing with every passing year. June Binney, Director of Criminal Justice Diversion for the National Alliance on Mental Illness, Massachusetts, thank you so very much for your time.
Thank you for having me.
We'll be back. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. From the public gardens to the Old South Meeting House and the Quincy Market, Boston is a city of historic landmarks. We preserve these places for their architectural beauty, their historical significance, and the impact they had on society. But what if we preserved locations for other reasons? What if we preserved for, say, sustainability, or to stand against gentrification, or to challenge societies to confront ugly pasts? Well, that's the progressive preservation movement contemplated by Max Page, a professor of architecture and history at the University of Massachusetts. He says preservation is not just about the past. It's about building the more just communities of the future. In other words, he says, this is not your grandmother's preservation movement. He's got a new book about it called Why Preservation Matters, and he joins us now from Amherst, Mass. Welcome to Radio Boston.
Thanks so much, Megan.
Okay, so I'd love to hear about this new preservation movement, and your book begins with an example actually in Medellin, Colombia. So tell us about that.
Well, I spent last fall in Medellin, Colombia, which many people know is one of the cities most affected by the violent drug wars of the 80s and 1990s that hopefully is coming to an end now. And they're in the midst of recovering that city. And I really mean that, recovering the public life, recovering the public spaces of that city. And so that was a model for me, or at least an inspiration as I was writing this book, thinking about what role preservation should play in the future.
So give me a specific example. How does this differ than, you know, all the examples that I gave at the top of the segment here?
Right. So those are obviously some great landmarks, and it's important to keep our history and these you know, significant buildings in the past. But I'm interested in how preservation can solve some of the key problems of facing us today. So sustainability, for example, half of all carbon is created by the construction, demolition of, and maintenance of buildings. Mm-hmm. We're not going to build our way out of the climate crisis. We're going to have to conserve our way, preserve our way out of it. So we have this wonderful lead platinum that is, you know, very low energy building, Genzyme, over in Cambridge. But those platinum buildings are nothing compared to reusing 100 or 200-year-old building for new uses.
Right. I mean, because the materials that already exist have the least, the smallest carbon footprint because they've already made their carbon footprint.
Exactly.
So we can aim for preservation for sustainability. That one is pretty easy to understand. What about this larger issue of preservation as an act of social justice? What do you mean by that?
Well, I think the that's meant to counter the attitude that preservation is used for gentrification. Mm-hmm. That preservation is for rich people. Preservation actually takes neighborhoods like, let's say, you know, South End, South Boston, and turns them into places for what I would used to call yuppies, wealthy young professionals and the like. But it doesn't have to be that way. The preservation can actually be about preserving communities in the way they and the mix that they have. And, you know, an organization that I love in Boston is City Life, Vida Urbana, which is doing a kind of preservation that I think this movement needs to think about. That is, they're trying to keep people in their homes when big banks trying to have them evicted. And they wouldn't call themselves historic architectural preservationists, but in fact they're doing what preservationists hope to do, which is to try to preserve the mix of a community, preserve the rights of people to stay in their homes.
Interesting. So this isn't so much the question of a physical fabric, but the less, I was going to say less tangible, but it's not really, because it's very tangible, the social fabric of a community.
Exactly. In fact, I think where one way the preservation movement has drifted throughout the 20th century and in the last 50 years was towards emphasizing architecture too much. Now, you may say, well, that's crazy. You know, preservation is, of course, it's about historic architecture. Well, that's not necessarily true. In fact, when early on in our country's history, we were preserving sites related to important historic events and Independence Hall, George Washington's Mount Vernon. The interest was in important historic sites, not necessarily in architectural significance. And I think, in a way, we need to go back to it's back to the future, in which we embrace, think about the places that matter to us, and not necessarily because of their architectural significance.
Okay, so give me another example. I mean, you've talked about, for example, a form of preservation that has to deal with confronting history.
Right. I think one of the things that was in 1966, when this National Historic Preservation Act was signed, it was signed 50 years ago, 2 weeks ago, the country was not nearly as diverse as it is today. The waves of migrants from Asia, from Latin America, had only just begun. So we are a far more diverse polity than we once were. And so to deal with that, we need to preserve and interpret the places of a wide range of Americans and confront the really controversial pasts at places like the Japanese-American internment camp at Manzanar in California. Or I'm working on a project in Richmond, Virginia at Shaco Bottom, which was the second largest slave market in the United States in the 19th century. And yet there was nothing, until very recently, there was nothing to market, nothing to tell you that that is what happened at that place. So if we're really going to try to build a unified nation out of an increasingly diverse country, we're going to have to at least start by really documenting and interpreting those most difficult sites in our past.
And making them worthy of memorial, right? I mean, that's kind of what you're calling for in another term. But let me ask you, if we switch gears here a little bit, because your new sort of take on preservation is so broad-reaching that there were parts which I have to say I struggled with a little bit. Like for example, you give an example in the book that the University of Massachusetts campus itself in Amherst may not necessarily be beautiful, but it's not something we would typically think is worth preserving, but you say it has a beauty of purpose. Now, how does that fit into all of this?
Well, I first would argue that the UMass campus is actually significant for its architecture. Some of the most important architects of the mid-century, 1950s, 60s, and 70s, did work there, and that's an important story in our history. But I actually argue for my own home building, the Fine Arts Center, designed by Kevin Roach, an architect of 95 years old, still living in Connecticut, that also is important to save because it signifies our commitment to a public university for the broad mass of our citizens.
Mm.
They built the biggest fine arts center west of Boston, biggest arts complex west of Boston in the late 60s and early 70s. They picked up 646 feet of south-facing North-facing light, you know, studios up for undergraduates from working-class families. That was an important symbol about a commitment to building a great public university for Massachusetts citizens. So in some ways, it's important because Kevin Roche, this famous architect, designed it, but I think it's also needs to be preserved and its story told because of its social statement.
Yeah. So let me ask you what you think about another example that we were discussing earlier today. Our staff was discussing, what about Boston City Hall and City Hall Plaza? Because on the one hand, there's always a debate over the relative merits of the brutalist architecture that it embodies. But there's also, I mean, City Hall Plaza also embodies a particular historic moment, right, in terms of urbanism and economic decisions made to, you know, obliterate Boston's West End to build this place. And so that we have the memory of displacement of large numbers of people, the transformation of a neighborhood, the new City Hall. I mean, it's all going on there. Does that make the City Hall Plaza as it currently stands worth preserving in your mind? Or because what I'm wondering is it's still in a lot of people still think it doesn't serve any purpose and is kind of ugly and should be radically changed.
Well, I'll tell you one thing. I'm rarely in favor of museum approach to preservation, where we try to bring something back to the moment it was created and get very fussy about those details. In fact, that's one of my big criticisms of the preservation movement. So I'm all for using it, reusing it, and making appropriate changes where necessary. From a sustainability side, I certainly think you don't just tear something like that down, you reuse it. I happen to think that there were a lot of changes made to that building that actually undermined some of the glories of it. I'm a little bit of a fan of the building itself. I do think that the plaza has never really worked. I think it barely gets packed even when the Patriots win the Super Bowl.
Yeah.
So it needs work, and it's one of the most controversial, obviously, touchstones in these debates. But the building should be reused, and we should respect the motives, the best motives that were behind it, and then adapt it to the needs we have today.
Yeah. Well, of course, we're having this conversation with you as voters in the city of Boston are considering ballot question number 5, which is just pertinent to them. It's the Community Preservation Act, where the city would assess a 1% surcharge on all property tax bills, exemptions for seniors and low-income homeowners. And that money would go towards affordable housing, open space acquisition, or historic preservation. Does ballot question number 5 sort of fall into this concept of a new form of preservation that you're talking about in the book?
Well, I'm totally for it. We have it in Amherst, and I think 160 communities in Massachusetts have signed on to the Community Preservation Act. So I'm all for it. It generates $20 million largely progressively from bigger commercial owners. As you said, there's subsidies or there's relief for those at the lower end of the economic spectrum. Whether it does the kind of preservation movement I'm interested in all depends on how the money gets used.
Right.
If the money is that's dedicated to preservation gets spent on restoring, training young people to restore old buildings that then become affordable housing, that is right up my alley in the way I think we should be going. If it's simply about getting the paint color right on a historic mansion, maybe not so good.
Well, Max Page is professor of architecture and history at the University of Massachusetts Amherst. He's author of the new book, Why Preservation Matters. Mr. Page, thank you so very much for joining us. It's been absolutely fascinating to talk with you. Thanks again.
Thank you.
We'll be back in a moment. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston. Welcome back. It's Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. In the eyes of its most fervent believers, technology is supposed to be a great equalizing force. Data and the tools we create from that information are supposed to eliminate base human behaviors like sexism and racism. Sadly, it doesn't always work out that way. Take the new study that's found troubling signs of racial discrimination from Uber drivers in Boston. The company's drivers here were twice as likely to cancel rides for passengers with African-American-sounding names. That's according to the report by the Cambridge-based National Bureau of Economic Research. Christopher Knittel co-authored the study. He's a professor of economics at MIT's Sloan School of Management, and he joins us now in the studio. Welcome to Radio Boston.
Thank you for having me.
Also with us is Damon Cox. He's Director of Economic Development and Entrepreneurship at the Boston Foundation. Damon Cox, welcome to you.
Thank you.
So, Professor Knittel, tell us first about this study. I mean, you found that Uber drivers were more than twice as likely to cancel rides for passengers with African-American-sounding names. How did you determine that?
So we ran two large-scale randomized controlled experiments, one in Seattle and one in Boston. In Seattle, we had research assistants of both ethnicities hailing cabs, Uber cars and Lyft cars. And in Boston, what we did is we had the same research assistant have two accounts. One account had a more African-American sounding name, and one account had a more white sounding name. And they would randomly choose which account they hailed the service from.
Okay. And so so you found generally that out of the many, what, hundreds of times you did this?
We took about 1,400 Uber and Lyft rides.
Okay, in Boston.
900 in Boston.
In Boston, okay. That that folks with African-American sounding names were more than twice as likely to have their rides canceled. How did that break down between supposedly black female sounding names and black male sounding names?
So it was predominantly among black male sounding names where the cancellations occurred. But overall, we found a doubling in cancellation when you used a black sounding name.
And how did that differ from the results you found in Seattle?
So in Seattle, we weren't collecting data on cancellations. What we collected data on were how long it took for the ride to be accepted and how long it took for the driver to come and pick you up. And in Seattle, what we found is if you were a black research assistant, it took longer for both the rides to be accepted and for the driver to come pick you up.
Now, there's something specific about the different ways in which drivers who are on Lyft services versus Uber services are alerted about new riders that factors into here. Can you tell us about that?
Yeah, that's correct. So if you're a Uber driver, you don't see the name of the passenger until you accept the ride. If you're a Lyft driver, you see both the name and a profile photo before you accept the ride. So we shouldn't see the cancellation effect among Lyft drivers because they can simply pass you up rather than accepting and canceling.
So their racism can actually be more hidden because we don't even know if they're canceling people. They're just ignoring them.
That's correct. And we don't find an effective name among Lyft drivers because you shouldn't.
Okay, so that's how you could measure the cancellation rate with the Uber drivers because they've had to accept the rider, then they find out the name,
And then they have to cancel.
They're hitting the cancel.
Correct.
Okay. So, Damon Cox, jump in here. First of all, I mean, what's your reaction to Christopher Knittel's findings about ride-hailing services in Boston?
Well, you know, it's extremely disappointing, but I don't know if it's necessarily surprising. I think we're seeing a lot of technology kind of being influenced by human decisions. Of course, humans write algorithms. But there is implicit and unconscious bias in a lot of everything that we do. So, you know, for a Uber or Lyft driver to kind of make that last minute decision, you know, whether it be unconscious or explicit, or just straight up prejudice, I guess isn't that surprising, unfortunately.
Yeah. You know, one thing that, that's so fascinating about this study is that part of the attraction of these new technologies, of these ride-hailing services, is that they were supposed to overcome what seems to be fairly well-documented trends in older forms of transportation, like taxi services. There's long been complaints from communities of color that it was harder to get a taxi ride or that people wouldn't pick them up because of where they lived, what they looked like, and things like that. And ride-hailing services and the technology that they deploy were supposed to, you know, overcome that. And in fact, both Uber and Lyft say one of the things that they're most proud of is that they're able to get, or they say they're increasing transportation options in exactly these communities. I mean, Damon Cox, are you seeing the two things as, can they be compatible or not?
I think that ultimately the decision by these companies, and here's the thing, I don't want to say that either Uber or Lyft are guilty of these practices, but I think if they don't do anything about any of this, they are complicit. If you look, just a couple days ago, Airbnb just released a community commitment letter, which requires anyone who utilizes their service to sign off on this. And if they decide not to sign off on it, they can't be an Airbnb participant. And it basically says if you discriminate based on race, gender, sexual orientation, or, you know, and so on and so forth, you cannot be a member of the Airbnb community. And I think that these companies need to be proactive. Uber and Lyft, I don't believe they have that type of agreement when you do agree to become a driver. So, you know, perhaps that's the next step in kind of bringing true equality to the service.
Yeah, Christopher, can it'll jump in here? What's your thoughts on that? Because Airbnb has made some significant changes in just the past couple of weeks.
Yeah, I want to be clear with one thing. We're not at all saying Uber and Lyft are worse than the status quo system. In fact, in Seattle, we had research assistants stand at corners trying to hail cabs. And if you were black, 60% of the time, the first cab would pass you. And if you were white, only 20% of the time, it would pass you. So discrimination exists in the status quo system. What we are saying is that Uber and Lyft can do better if they wanted to. They could completely get rid of names and profile photos if they wanted to. It comes with some cost, but that would eliminate this type of discrimination because the driver would never see who they're picking up until they're right there.
So you'd be issued some kind of random number or
sure.
something that would then match you with the driver that comes to pick you up?
Right.
Okay.
Right. Now, there's a cost to that, right? Because we've been told, and certainly in my experience, I like to know the name of the driver. It makes the relationship more personal.
Uh-huh. Now, what about I mean, hearing from both of you, Christopher and Damon, that this says a lot about the drivers and the decisions they're making. But beyond this sort of fully anonymizing that Christopher Knittel just suggested as a potential technological fix, I mean, Christopher, respond to what Damon Cox was saying about the changes that Airbnb has made specifically. I mean, should ride-hailing services be more proactive in terms of setting standards for their expectations of their drivers?
Yeah, I believe it's the case that when you actually sign up to be a driver, you agree not to discriminate. The key, of course, is enforcement and oversight. So another fix or potential option available to them would be to police canceling more frequently and to limit how much a given driver can cancel trips.
Hmm. Well, listeners, I'm wondering what you think about this. We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 800-423-TALK. Have you had an experience like we're describing here, wondering why your ride got canceled all of a sudden? Or if you're an Uber driver or Lyft driver, would love to hear your perspective as well. And, you know, how can these new economy companies, these new tech companies do better when it comes to doing their part to eliminating or reducing implicit bias that seems to surround us everywhere we go? Call us at 800-423-8255, 800-423-TALK. We have a statement here, by the way, that was sent to us from Rachel Holt, head of North American Operations for Uber, because we did reach out to them to see if they could join us. And in the statement, they say, ride-sharing apps are changing a transportation status quo that has been unequal for generations, making it easier and more affordable for people to get around, no matter who they are or where they live. Discrimination has no place in society and no place on Uber. We believe Uber is helping reduce transportation inequities across the board, but studies like this one are helpful in thinking about how we can do even more. Damon Cox, jump in here. We've been seeing these kind of stories with increasing frequency, especially in the Boston area. There, you mentioned Airbnb. There was also the Amazon decision,
sure,
which they undid quickly. They originally didn't have same-day delivery service available in places like Roxbury. They
sure.
said there were business and data reasons for that, but obviously they changed their thinking there. Do you have a concern that data and data-driven businesses may actually be coming late to these to thinking about how their data might actually exacerbate bias or racism? And I'm really thinking of the Amazon example as one of them, because on the one hand, they could have been saying, hey, like, for all the numbers reasons, this is why we made the decision. But it was only after the fact that they thought, well, actually, it wasn't such a good idea.
Yeah, you know, my main concern is, you know, I don't want the redlining of decades ago to kind of be repeated with the innovation economy. And that's what we're seeing with what's happening with Amazon, with this report kind of revealing what's happening with Uber and Lyft and other ride-sharing services. That's my fear, you know, where certain geographies, certain parts of the city, people with certain names are denied services just based upon, you know, what their name sounds like or where they live. So I think it's really incumbent upon all of us that are connected to the innovation economy to really hold these companies to task, to make certain that they're aware. And I think it really starts with kind of diversifying some of these companies from within. I think that if these companies are more diverse from within, externally, internally, if they get their house together, externally, they'll be a stronger company as well.
Let's take a call here. Phoebe's calling from Brighton. You're on the air, Phoebe.
Hi, how you doing?
I'm doing well. What's your thought?
My thought is that I've read that companies like Uber and Lyft are going to be using metrics to tell their drivers things about how they're driving, if they're stopping too quickly, if they're taking too many unsafe turns. And my thought is just that perhaps they could use a similar type of metric to tell their drivers if they thought they were canceling unfairly or discriminating on the basis of any number of different attributes of the riders.
Phoebe, great question and idea. Thank you for your call. Christopher Knittle, your thought on that?
Well, that's exactly right. These companies have a rich amount of data that they could mine to analyze how prevalent discrimination is. One thing that we couldn't get at in our study but is just as important is where do drivers choose to service? Mm-hmm. You've heard the anecdotes that you can't get a cab in Brooklyn or the Bronx, and that might be going on as well with Uber and Lyft.
Yeah. I'd like to get another call here. Leah is calling from Somerville. You're on the air, Leah.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I just had a kind of a general observation. I use Uber fairly frequently, and I noticed that not very few times have I had a driver that's of white descent. I feel like there's a pretty diverse group of drivers from Uber and Lyft, and I'm just wondering if you could speak to that as far as whether or not, who are the drivers that are discriminating against certain racial groups?
Leah, thank you so much for your call. Damon Cox, you have a thought on that?
That's interesting. It's funny because I'm an African-American male that utilizes both services quite often. And I think maybe I've had two cars canceled from me. So I'm coming from a different perspective. But I have spoken with folks that have had that happen to them, where their rides are constantly canceled. As far as the ethnicities of the drivers, I think it's a pretty even split for me. I think it really depends where you live. So it would be more disturbing, I think, if you found that more drivers, which were people of color, were canceling more rides of riders of color.
Right. Well, Christopher Knittle, you're the one who did the study. Tell us about this.
So we actually wanted to analyze that, but whenever you run a big randomized control trial like this, you have to go through a committee of faculty, and one of the rules is that you can't do harm on any of the participants. So we actually were not allowed to collect the data on the drivers because they were concerned that repercussions could be they could face repercussions from any discrimination.
Yeah. Well, in the last couple minutes that we have, actually, you know what? I'm going to try and sneak in another call here because we've got an Uber driver on the line. Sarah is calling from Lowell. You're on the air, Sarah.
Hi. I had three quick points. I'm a female driver. I'm one of the few drivers. I've never had a bad experience, but I do have concerns about fully anonymizing drivers and riders because I think that's one of the key safety features that we rely on as drivers. Second, I'm one of the few I've noticed people of white descent that drives, and one of the few females. So I'm wondering what factor that plays, the race of the driver. And lastly, I wanted to say that there have been some misstatements made so far. We actually get kicked out of the system as drivers if we cancel too many rides.
Right.
We get told if our threshold is below 80% for rides that we are kicked off. I'm no longer allowed to drive.
Yeah, no, Sarah, I'm going to jump in here because we've got less than a minute to go before I have to close the show down, but I appreciate your clarification there. I think the question is Uber measuring who the drivers are canceling on and making their decisions based on that? And it doesn't seem like that so far.
Well, so we find that the average cancellation rate for white passengers is 5%, and for blacks it's over 10%. So you would still be under that threshold.
Well, Christopher Knittle is professor of economics at MIT's Sloan School of Management, and he's co-author of the new National Bureau of Economic Research paper on racial and gender discrimination on ride-hailing services. Really eye-opening. Thank you so very much for joining us, and thank you for the study.
Thank you for having me.
And Damon Cox, I absolutely hear your call for making the ranks of tech more diverse in terms of people making those algorithms as part of the solution here. Damon Cox is Director of Economic Development and Entrepreneurship at the Boston Foundation. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
That's all the time we have today. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston.